Hello and welcome to the Bigger Picture Podcast. Today I have with me Neil Balms, a research fellow at the Moshe Dayan Center and the director for the Program for Regional Cooperation here in the Middle East. Neil, welcome to the show.
Good to be here.
So we are definitely living in a post-October 7th world, and we feel that on an individual level, as I'm sure you have, being in uniform for the past 4 months. But there are shifts here on the societal level here in Israel and definitely in the entire region of the Middle East. Tell us, what did the Middle East look like pre-October 7th, where we had the Abraham Accords, we had conversations with Saudi Arabia, and there was a general feeling of hope that the Palestinian conflict wasn't going to derail the progress in the Middle East. And that shifted after October 7th. So paint us a picture here. Where were we before and how have things changed?
Ronnie, before October 7th, and we're not talking about just a month. This is a years-long process. At the early days, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has certainly been a major part of the agenda in the Middle East. It continues to be so, certainly following October 7. It was an important agenda before October 7, but there was a growing realization that the Middle East needs to move. If we are looking at the real challenges that this region faces, with over 100 million people, young people who are unemployed and do not know really where and what to do tomorrow and how they're going to live their lives, the ideas that eventually led also, amongst other things, the Abraham Accords, was that we need better integration, that we need economic cooperation, that we need to focus on prosperity. And for that, we need peace. We need the ability to work together. So the formula that was eventually adopted or led by some of our Gulf partners, tolerance leads to peace, peace leads to prosperity. Really, it's about prosperity. It's about the idea of having a collective regional gain. And in order to do that, we need to find a way to accept each other, find a way to work with each other. So create degrees of cooperation. And for that, we need degrees of normalization. And that will enable all of us to get the Israeli-Palestinian conflict have always been a thorn in all of this. And we could not move. We look at the Middle East through the prism of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This was the barometer. One of the things that had happened with the Abraham Accords is that for a period of time, and perhaps, you know, in a deeper way even now, this equation has changed. We are not able to, we do not want to leave the Middle East and all these over 100 million people out of the 450 million Arabs who live in the Middle East hostage to these dynamics that are really propagated by radicals. So we want to move forward and find a path forward. And we're now able to look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through the prism of the Middle East, kind of reversing the prism and saying, well, perhaps the Palestinians could also move to a similar point. And we will be able to work with our Palestinian colleagues and find, again, a win-win formula. Because eventually the prosperity of people, and we see it now when Gaza is really destroyed, for the sake of the people in Gaza, we need to find a way to work with Israel for a better future. Otherwise, we're driving all of us into an agenda of demise, of war and demise. And that's exactly the opposite of what the Abraham Accords trajectory sought to create. So now, in some ways, we're getting back to the old prism, but perhaps not completely, because I don't think that all the other players in the Middle East have really sort of quote-unquote changed their mind and now would like to run the future based just on the barometer of Israeli-Palestinian dynamics.
Right. I want to highlight something that you're speaking to here. There were so many attempts and so many initiatives that tried to make peace and to bring prosperity, whether we're speaking of Palestinians or whether we're speaking about the wider Middle East. there were real conversations, there were real initiatives taking place. And that was the Israeli approach. Overall, there were so many people here, some of them living in the southern towns on the Gaza border, who were invested in bringing peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And the narrative today, I think, is so destructive because it's an anti-truth. The fact that we hear people saying that Israelis were exploiting Palestinians, that Palestinians were poor and had no future because we were oppressing them. And that couldn't be further from the truth. We opened up jobs, we let them in and have some economic growth, but all of the funding that went into Gaza, for instance, went into terror. It went into building tunnels and it went into rockets and ammunition. So I think this is so important for people to understand what great efforts were taken to bridge this gap. And it's not for lack of trying that we didn't succeed here. So how do you see our future with the Palestinians? Now, apparently, they're getting a state after the massacre, a reward for the terror. But what do you see the most important steps in de-radicalizing, first of all, but also bringing some sort of economic prosperity to these regions?
Well, I'm not sure if we have 2 days to answer this question or only a few minutes. But let me start in the following point. A few months ago, I hosted a dinner in my house with Vivian Silver, one of the names that became, unfortunately, very well known after she was killed in October 7 in her home in Kibbutz Be'eri. And she was known as one of the key activists of the peace movement in Israel. And she was in my home along with another very interesting friend called Manar al-Sharif. Manar al-Sharif is a Palestinian who studied in Gaza and who created the Gaza Youth Committee. That's an old, a very interesting story, as she was a young person who wanted to understand what's happening on the other side. She represented the voice of hope. She met Vivian Silver on Zoom. She created a number of Zoom calls to understand who are these other Israelis. They were working together until Hamas caught this work, put her in prison for a number of months. She was eventually able to leave and then escape to the Gulf. And from there, we were able to help her come to Israel to meet in person some of the people that she had spent so many months speaking. This was the exact conversation about hope. And, you know, we said that hope is the last to die. I have seen voices of hope coming from the Palestinians. I belong to the group of people that spent hours and days with conversing with Palestinians. I do this until today because I believe that eventually the degree of rationalism must prevail, and also that for the sake of the future, that's what we need to do. We cannot let Hamas and that mindset win. And I think there are Palestinians still who support this, although I would love to see more of them. Of course, we've had a process that eventually gave the Palestinians a state. Hamas took it by force, but nevertheless, in 2006, it was the first time that there was a Palestinian state. It had the opportunity of being a Singapore of the Middle East, not the Afghanistan of the Middle East. And I think Hamas have brought it all the way to the abyss. What we are hearing now is that perhaps there is a way to revive all of this in order to bring this notion of the state back to the table. I think without getting into all the intricacies of the issues involved with this is conceptual. A statement by the Americans in that sense is not necessarily going to change the realities on the ground, or convince Yahya Sinwar to move away from his tunnels. I wish that was the case. I wish that our Arab friends or partners could help us really do it sooner. I think many lives in Gaza would be safe. But I also think it's important not to kill that hope. And I think it's important to say that for many Israelis, this notion of a Palestinian or a Palestinian state is not something that we're not willing to accept. I think part of the question was always when we had these discussions is, can the Palestinians really say, like we are willing to say, that they're willing to acknowledge Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people? Can they acknowledge that we have a right to be here, as we have acknowledged that they have the right to be here? I think today it's much more difficult to convince Israelis that Palestinians have the right to be here because, simply speaking, after they're being, you know, given the chance to create something, rather than building their own state, they're trying to build an entity and an infrastructure that is trying to kill us. And they've been spending all of this time building infrastructure, tunnels, missiles, rockets, just to create this type of a war. They've been preparing for years for this. And this is not preparing for a better future for the Palestinians. This is a preparation of a perpetual war against us. And then you're saying, okay, so now we need to give them quote unquote a reward. With all of this, I still think that we must give hope a chance. Because if we're not able to really replace our neighbors, if we're not going to ask, let's say, the Dutch or the Norwegians or the Canadians or the Americans to just come and be our neighbors, but it's not an easy thing to do technically. We need to find a way to find a modus operandi, to find a way to live with the Palestinians. And there are people that are willing to speak this discourse, but it needs to be clear for anyone who cares about the Palestinian future that the understanding here that we need to change, fundamentally change, this mindset and the leadership, because Hamas, what it was able to do for the Palestinians so far, just create perpetual war and really bring significant resources that came nowhere close to the people and eventually brought their demise and destruction. And I hope that some Palestinians will begin to say, you know what, my friends, perhaps we had it wrong. Perhaps we should do it differently. Perhaps the idea of engagement and acceptance of the other can actually help us build a better future. And I think they'll need to work hard to convince the Israelis. And even if there's going to be a broader framework of trying to create like a grand bargain, I mean, it's still Palestinians on the ground eventually will need to show that they need to gain the trust of the Israelis. And they need to gain this trust of the Israelis because there are too many of them that their way of engagement is literally by inflicting terror. And we've seen it now day in and day out. And we see this on their educational system. And we see this entire mindset that educates not for the idea of creating peace, but for the idea of creating some sort of a replacement theology. There's one part. When somebody says, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, irrespective if they understand which river and which sea there is, they're basically saying, look, I am for the Palestinian cause. I understand that the Palestinian cause is to have no Jewish state and let the Israelis no place to live. How do you want the Israelis to understand this when they see even on American campuses these slogans? So what do these slogans say? They said, look, my dear friends, I know that you have a state, but we are for the Palestinian cause. We believe that you do not exist here. We do not believe in peace. We chant this saying that we believe that you do not belong here. And how do you want Israelis to respond to this when the when still people here would say, we believe that there needs to be a way to live together. We believe that there needs to be a way to share the country. And the Palestinians and their supporters are saying, no, from the river to the sea, Palestine should be free. You Israelis, Jews, have no right here. And until that mindset is not changed, it's very difficult to imagine a different future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I heard Barry Weiss spoke about this when the war broke out. She said that she believed for her whole adult life that land for peace is a workable model. And we have seen what land for peace brings us, right? The Gaza Strip, the fact that we relinquished that land and it turned into a totalitarian terror state, that has broken down a lot of people's hope for the future. And while hope is important, I think a sober look at reality and the hard truths that we're facing is also important. And I come from a very psychological framework. And when I see children who are being told by their parents that to die for a cause is the greatest honor, when a parent is willing to sacrifice their child, the psychological damage that that does for an entire generation, for 15 years, they have been fed these horrific, horrific ideologies. So moving forward, even people here in Israel who are praying for peace, you know, when the war broke out, I was listening to old Israeli songs, and so many of them talk about peace. We dream of peace. We pray for peace. That's all we want. We want to live beside the Palestinians and cooperate and each live our own lives. Now, I think that a lot of people are waking up to the really hard truths of what's going on the ground in Palestine. We see that in Gaza, and we see that also in Judea and Samaria. So what do you think can actually happen, needs to happen to change the, you know, the human element here, the way they perceive us and the way they perceive the world? And right now we are working with people who want us dead and believe that dying is better than living. How do you negotiate? How do you work with people like that?
We are facing with a difficult challenge, and I'm not even sure when are we going to start, because at this point, it's very difficult to see a reliable partner that comes from the Palestinian side with whom we can speak and negotiate. This has been tried in the last 20 years. It almost really never materialized. What we're seeing now is other people in the international community saying, wait a minute, let's figure out if from this abyss we can create some sort of a grand bargain that will be able to bring something together. And over there, we need to figure out a process, a long process that will be able to bring back a degree of trust, which obviously does not exist. You know, when I was born, when I had my break in the eighth day, my father, just like many other, had added another prayer. He says, I really hope that you would not need to open the closet. What did he mean by that? There was a closet in the house, and every house where all the uniforms and the equipment for reserve. That's where it is. And he thought, you know, by the time you will reach 18, I'm sure you would not need to do what I did. You would not need to go to fight the wars that I had been fighting. Well, you know, now 4 months in uniform, I'm not sure that really had worked, but I'm sure that I'm going to continue with that tradition. And I will continue this prayer forward, because one day, hopefully, we will see this materialize. Again, hope is the last to die, and I don't want to kill it. I very much recognize where we are. And it's, I think it's going to be very difficult to convince any Israeli that all of a sudden, you know, we can create something that will bring peace, and that peace will really emerge just like we have in many of these songs. But what potentially we can do, what needs to happen, is a real shift and a real change in leadership. And I think we actually have a chance, because Israel, for its own reason, is going to go through a very deep process that already began of introspection. October 7th, everything that happened before October 7th brings us to a point similar to 1973, we need to think carefully about us and about the future. The same can be said about the Palestinians. And perhaps the Palestinians needs to capture this moment and says, look, that's the time from this pit, from this crisis, to come out with something different, to come out with a new vision, and to develop a different course that's not going to take a day or two. It may take another generation, but they need to prove to us and to ourselves that something else can happen. I believe that the Israelis, still, after all of this, we are the people of hope. We have hope as a national, and that's why every time when somebody asks me, how is it that you dare to speak about hope? I say, I'm an Israeli. That's my national anthem. I refuse to forget about hope. Did we really think that the Japanese or the Germans could emerge as they were following the Second World War? Sure, it took a very abrasive process in order to help create that change. But I think third generation Japanese and third generation Germans are very different and have a very different mindset and outlook about the world. And I think this was a transition that had happened really from the worst into really being part of the leadership of the free and liberal world. Can the Palestinians do the same? I don't know. But I don't want to lose the hope that we will find a way to work together. Because Israel still is stronger. And as somebody who advocates for hope, I found myself in uniform fighting in this war, realizing that we had no choice. But with all of this, we're not losing hope. We would like to find a way to make a difference and do it better.
I think that's an important message. And bringing us back to hope is the only thing we can do in these hard times. And it's what we have done. As Elie Wiesel said, as Viktor Frankl said, hope is important. These are two people who were in the Holocaust in concentration camps, for anyone who doesn't know. But hope is our legacy. And that's how we keep standing up and striving. I want to zoom out really quick for the brief time we have left to talk about Iran and their involvement and their puppeteering here in the Middle East and how they have radicalized certain countries like Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and the Gaza Strip. What is Iran doing? And I would also like to know, are all Iranians anti-Semitic and for terror, or is this really driven by a radical elite?
Well, the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran had changed a trajectory of a country. And beforehand, Iran was a country with whom Israel had diplomatic relations. He had ambassadors in Iran. The Jews who fled Iraq after the rise of Saddam Hussein to power, almost a decade before the Islamic Revolution, where did they go to? They escaped to Iran, because that was the safe haven. That was the safe place Israeli companies had worked. It's also important to say, something in the context of the Shia and the Sunni divide in Islam. Of course, Iranians are Shia, and some are saying, look at Iran, look at Hezbollah. These are the radicals in the Muslim world, but that's also not entirely true, certainly not historically speaking. The Shias were the ones who created, from the Shias emerged the Baha'is, from the Shia emerged the Sufis, from the Shia emerged the Druze. And these are groups that are known for their moderation and tolerance and progressive spirit, or Iran's themselves. I have Iranian friends and colleagues. I have been writing and working with Iranians. We know that the Iranians have been trying for decades now to change course in their own country, that the younger people of Iran have went into the streets in 1989, in 1999, the Green Revolution, almost in every decade almost to the year, we've had people marching into the streets saying, we want a change. Recently, with Masha Amini, with the hijab protests, the Iranian people are amongst the more secular, actually, in the Arab world. They are the most open, amongst the most open-minded. They're not Arabs. And they are very well educated and very well advanced. So again, if we're looking at this notion and constant notion of hope, it's leadership and it's ideological leadership. And in that sense, it's a theological leadership. Unfortunately, what Iran was able to do is that radical Islamist ideology coming from the Shia world is able to connect with radical Islamist ideology for the Sunni world, and then putting Israel in the middle of it. And part of what we need to do, also theologically speaking, is find a way to neutralize some of these voices and come to terms with what I hope is the divine mission that all of us received from God, is to cherish this world that God had created. And I think all of us, Jews, Muslims, Christians, are actually tasked with this. This idea that God created the world and we are tasked to keep it, to protect it, to make it better. We have many challenges. Destroying each other is not helping us do this. But that's something that needs to come really from leadership. It needs to come from those who preach at the masks. It needs to come from those who are at the political helm. The Iranians, just like Hamas, just like Hezbollah, which are really, in many ways, they're proxies. And now there's a whole list of proxies in Syria and in Lebanon. And now in Gaza, they're trying to encircle Israel with a very different mindset, with the mindset of struggle. The Iranians, for those who do not know, back at the Iran-Iraq war, they were known for, they did not have enough engineering equipment, so they needed to deal with the Iraqi mines, the landmines that had protected the border. And they found a very creative way of doing this. They sent kids. They gave them keys to heaven, and they sent kids to blow the mines. They are still proudly teach that episode and saying that 36,000 young Iranian children had given their life to the revolution to invade Iraq. And that exact mindset is the one that I hope we will be able not just to fight. We need the right leadership. We need the right leadership from the religious side, from the political side, in the Arab and in the Muslim world, that will say that this is utterly wrong, that this cannot be tolerated, that we have to fight, we have a joint fight against the radical. We have some difficult voices here. We have some radical elements in our society, just like we have in every other society. But if the moderates in all society are not going to come together to fight the radicals will prevail. The radicals will win. It's easy. When you see so much radicalization from the other side, it will trigger radicalization from the other side. And it's a mammoth challenge. In with Iran as well, we have a chance, because if you listen to the voices of the people, if you listen to the demonstrators, you realize we have a chance. We need to help them. Hopefully they'll prevail. I think we have seen enough destruction in the Middle East. I think if you really look at the challenges we have, they're not just about Israelis and Palestinians. They're about water. They're about agriculture. They're about jobs. They're about global warming. That really influences people's lives here. There are about young people who need to find jobs. For that, we need to work together. And if we're going to spend our limited resources bombing each other, we're not going to make the life of the people in the Middle East better. And sure, I'm not sure that the language I speak is the language that the leadership, either of the Palestinians or the Iranians, speak yet. But that's the language we need to hear, or at least language similar to that. That you recognize that there is something bigger, that we need to take care of our people in the Middle East, and that we need to find a way to work together and neutralize the voices, calls to us to destroy each other.
Absolutely. Neil, you have given me hope in this very dark time, and I hope that this message gives other people hope, because there is a future, there is a way forward, and we need to maintain our legacy of hope and of peace, and to keep praying for peace, and to find ways to somehow cooperate and bring prosperity to the Middle East. So thank you so much for this message and for the work you do. I know I need to let you go because you're going to go on into uniform yet again. So thank you for your time. And I hope that this message ripples out.
Amen, Ronnie. And hopefully the hope will prevail. And even if we need to have more patience for it, we're never going to stop working because I think that's our legacy. And we need to work to create hope.
Amen.